Beloved listeners, and welcome to another hour of Advanced Living Radio. This is Kenneth Lesser, thrilled and delighted to be your host again today. Oh, what fun it is in the wonderful month of April. We missed having the show on April Fool's Day, so we'll have to have another kind of fun today. And since April Fool's Day was a few days ago, and you might have had some unusual things, the jokes pulled on you, we have the perfect guest to recover from April Fool's Day. Yeah, absolutely. Michael Ortiz Hill. And what does one need after they have been jostled or joked around with, or in the case of others, buffeted by some of the storms of life? I mean, there's a whole range of stuff going on, from that mild April Fool's joke on to very intense times when someone is on their way out into the next realm and dimension of living on the other side of the veil we call death. And our guest today, what a treat, folks, what a treat. This gentleman is here to help us to focus on one of the most wonderful commodities that gets us through almost any kind of situation in life. If there was one universal salve or balm to help heal, I don't think there would be anything better than the specialty of our dear friend Michael Ortiz Hill today, and that is compassion. And Michael, he's a registered nurse, he's a Buddhist practitioner, and of all things, yes, he's an initiated medicine man with the tribal people of Zimbabwe. You know, he couldn't find local Indians in America, so he had to go to Africa. I don't think that's the case, but it's quite wonderful that he was a world traveler and is here doing what he can to unite healers from all over the planet, Africa, America, you name it, any country, because the need for healing, the need for compassion is a universal need. And this is a man that has been doing some very interesting things. I mean, he was taught Buddhist meditation by his father as a teenager, received formal training in that, and because he ran out of things to do, maybe, he took a year and a half in solitude. And, of course, didn't, you know, speak. So there's some wonderful things that he has done to help really refine, and we'll just kind of allow Michael to come on board and sparkle and help us with some of the wonderful soothing balm of his special pathway to compassion. Welcome, Michael.
Hello, hello.
Hello. Now, I've thrown out the word compassion like everyone knows what it means.
So what does it mean anyway?
and it would be kind of nice, with your extensive background, for you to tell us from your perspective about what is compassion.
Mm-hmm. Well, compassion, you know, the Buddha's definition of compassion is sympathetic joy, which is, delighting in another's delight, and sympathetic sorrow, which is the grief with another's grief, effectively. And that's what I move with, you know, and the learning of compassion, of course. When I do teach classes on compassion to medical professionals, and also have done, taught in the schools here in L.A., Crenshaw High, which is in the inner city here. And what I did in Crenshaw High, I was doing a writing class, and I said, what is the joy of your joy in which you meet another's joy? What is the grief of your grief? Or what is the sorrow of your sorrow that you meet another's sorrow? These were 17-year-old kids, mostly black, some Latino, many of whom have suffered death because of the gang situation in South Central L.A., and they went for it. They went for it. And this is the Buddha's teaching. This is Buddha's compassion.
Now, when you say they went for it, were you that there as one of the peers and just kind of posing this question to some of the students, or were you in a teaching venue, or how did this take place?
I was a teacher. There was a grant for writing in the schools, and for 3 years I would go and spend a semester with the kids alongside dear Ernestine Hennings, who was the teacher that I've worked with the last 3 years.
Yeah. Okay, so you express this in a number of classes each day?
No, that was one day. Well, 2 days, really, because I presented the question and I gave examples to them. And we went with it. You know, I myself grew up in the barrio in New Mexico, and I was dealing with violence. You know, I'm biracial, my mother's Mexican, I'm a white boy, Latino guy, and the interracial violence was a very real part of my childhood. And through that, sympathetic sorrow, I could connect with these kids, mm-hmm. because they know what it is to be afraid for their skins.
Yeah.
And again, that's sympathetic sorrow from a Buddhist point of view.
Ah, wow.
Like solidarity, you know, with those who suffer.
Yeah. So now, I guess this might be expanding upon that a little bit, because in your work, I'm just curious, we mentioned a little bit about compassion from the Buddhist standpoint.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're kind of curious how do we get to actually realizing compassion? And part of your work is through your poetry, writings that you're doing, is about teaching it. So
yeah.
I'd like to kind of go a little bit further in those directions, please.
Sure. I hope finishing a final draft of my book, A Conspiracy of Kindness. The craft of compassion at the bedside of the ill. And when I teach compassion, I teach it as a craft. I teach it as learnable, you know. And this thing, what I was just speaking, sympathetic joy, sympathetic sorrow, it's a profound part of it because, well, I work with 4 steps, and the first step is self-compassion. That is the ground of everything. You cannot be compassionate towards another unless you're compassionate towards oneself. And it's really fundamental because people will burn out otherwise. And they will, there'll be a falseness. They will be compassionate at the expense of themselves, which is nonsense. It doesn't work at all.
be, they talk about people being like caretakers. I don't know if that they make a distinction between a caregiver or a caretaker. Somewhere in there, the idea that some people are being called upon to give beyond their capacity to care for themselves.
Well, that, you know, and it's a reality, and everybody learns often through their childhood, they learn not to care for themselves, and then they learn that caring is something they do at the expense of themselves. But the thing about self-compassion that I stress, a couple of things. One is know thyself, who is this one. When I was in my early 20s, my father had died. I had been homeless for 3 years as a teenager. And shortly after coming off the street, my lover, who swiftly became my wife, conceived with my daughter Nicole, who's now 30 years old. But I had to reconstruct a self. I had to step forth as a father, as a 20-year-old father, and after having been on the street and having been raised to the ground. And self-compassion became, how do you say, it was a profound teaching that was kind of my bread and butter. I mean, I had to learn what it meant for the sake of raising a child. I was a housewife for 3 years, so to speak. My wife was a special ed teacher. She still is, my ex-wife. And I stayed at home with my kid, and which was a time when I was just learning to be tender towards myself after having gone through a devastating experience and the loss of my father, of course. At any rate, a couple of years into that, I started working with people with cancer, doing hospice volunteering. And during those years, every year on my birthday, I would say, this is the last year of my life. How will I live? You know, it was a fiction that I lived within. My first hospice patient was a man who was a couple of years older than I. He had a baby my daughter's age, and he was dying of brain cancer. And I sat with him, and he recorded a tape recorded a letter to his daughter, because he knew that when she would come into being a child, she would probably forget who he was because she was just a baby, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that. And for myself, the rigor of that practice, this is the last year of my life, you know. How do I carry it? How do I live it? And it was the rigor of, you know, simply knowing the substance of who I am. This is a practice of self-compassion. What are the circumstances that you're born to? Related to that is what I call amor fati, which is the Latin for love one's fate. You know. What,
amor fati?
Amor fati, yeah.
That's A-M-O-R...
And then F-A-T-I, a separate word.
F-A-T-I, okay.
To love your fate, you know. What is it to love the fate of having been born to these parents? You know, my father was a profound Buddhist practitioner, and he was also a stone-cold alcoholic. And I watched him kill himself with liquor and cigarettes. That was how I grew up.
One of those unusual Buddhist sects that we haven't heard much about.
Well, you know, unfortunately, there's no lack of Buddhist alcoholics, you know, like any other sort of alcoholic.
Yeah. I guess when we don't know ourselves, I don't know how we can be very consistent, or congruent in our lives.
Yeah.
And so, wow, anyway, go on with what you were saying.
Well, I just the particulars of any given life, there's no lack of suffering. We all carry that. And again, that is the Buddhist teaching. That's the Buddha's teaching, the first noble truth. You know, we suffer down here. And that is also the ground of compassion. How do I relate to yet another suffering being with tenderness? And how do I relate to myself with kindness? You know?
Mm.
So anyway, amor fati, in this life, I have carried a certain measure of circumstantial. I mean, there's been anguish that I've had to face. And amor fati is, how does one say, thank you, God, for giving me this? What might I learn?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I like that. There's that opportunity to, what is it saying? Something about every cloud has a silver lining.
Mm-hmm.
Every large pile of manure has a pony in there somewhere.
Has a what now?
In every large pile of manure, there could be a pony.
Pony in the manure?
Yes, it's a...
I don't know if I can wrap my mind around that. But
yes, it's...
pony connected to the manure, maybe.
Well, I guess if you get enough of the manure out into the garden of your life,
there you are.
then you can uncover the hidden blessings, perhaps.
Exactly.
We don't know. It's just we do know that a steady diet of bemoaning our fate or being a constant complainer, that we've looked and there's hardly any job openings for that.
Well, again, that is, you no doubt know, again, profound Buddhist teaching, the image of the lotus. The lotus has its roots in the muck, you know?
Mm.
And the stuff of Buddhist practice is, how do you draw nourishment from the muck of being alive and make a radiant flower of it, in a nutshell.
Yeah.
And that's and that is also obviously about compassion. How does one work with the funky stuff of being human and bring forth compassion? And
yeah.
There's no
yeah.
nourishment for the flower without the muck. It's just the way it is.
Yeah. And isn't that interesting from that gardening or farming standpoint? We take the fecal matter, the oh my God, this is foul smelling stuff. This is terrible. We don't like it. They get rid of it, and then we mix that with some other things and put it into the soil, and what we get back from it is wonderful food.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's that, the story of the lotus growing out of this muck.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Huh. Okay, so there's the encouragement of this amor fati to love your fate.
So that's the first step. I mean, amor fati / self-compassion. Know thyself. You know, one cannot enter into the deep truth of self-compassion without knowing who you are. When I was, again, with the students at Crenshaw High, or when I've taught compassion to healthcare providers, what is the joy of your joy in which you meet another's joy? And what is the sorrow of your sorrow in which you meet another's sorrow? These are profound questions. One can, in one way or not, will spend one whole life answering it. But it's through one's joy that you understand, that you relate to, that you feel an affinity with the joy of another, and likewise with sorrow. So one goes from self-compassion to step two is compassion for another. And again, that is sympathetic joy, sympathetic sorrow. For myself, obviously, I threw myself into being a hospice volunteer, which was the radical stuff of the muck, you know, of having been homeless for 3 years and having been a dad changing diapers for another 3 years, you know, the feces, big time,
yes.
From both schools, and then, of course, taking care of people who had cancer and AIDS, and then becoming an RN over 20 years ago, and taking care of people who were in every possible circumstance, you know, from cancer, AIDS, multiple sclerosis, of course, which is another thing since I was diagnosed with MS. But my first patient, Elsie, bless her soul, Elsie was, she was 72 years old with MS, and I had just finished nursing school. I'd gone off to the forest for 3 months to be alone and meditate and prepare my heart to, in fact, practice as a nurse. I got my first job with Elsie for 4 years, working night shift alongside her bed. She was on a ventilator. She had only control over her facial muscles. And because she was on a vent, she couldn't speak. I would have to read her lips, which I could do pretty well. But typically, I would, if I couldn't get a word, I would disconnect her from her vent, take an Ambu bag, press air through her vocal cords so she could vocalize a word or two, and then I'd put her back on the vent.
Oh.
And with Elsie, you know, me being, I hesitate to say, a recovering Catholic boy, Buddhist, I spent 4 years meditating at Elsie's bedside, and it was month after month of meditating, and I would forever project the crucified God onto Elsie, pinned to a diagnosis, you know, nailed to a prognosis. And one time I came to work, and we had our evening chat, you know, before I put her to sleep and whatever, and she said, she said, "How are you?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I feel a little sad." And she said, "Why?" And I said, "I don't know. Life just seems sad to me sometimes." And she said, "I rarely feel sad." And I said, "Why is that, Elsie? People might think you would be a bit bitter." And she said, "I just don't let things bother me." Now, this is not the portrait of a woman midway through her crucifixion.
Yeah.
No. And this is after months of meditating, 5 hours a night at her bedside, you know, changing her, you know, whatever, giving her a bedpan, giving her pills, suctioning her tracheotomy, etc. And I would sit there in this hallucination, what Tibetans call idiot compassion. Idiot compassion is when you're in this idea, this posture of, oh, well, I'm the healthy, hale guy, and you're the poor wretch, and, you know, or whatever, that apartheid of the great distance between me and the so-called afflicted one. Elsie knew she was well-loved. She was a Pentecostal. She felt very cared for by Jesus. And, you know, I was projecting heroic fantasy. I was going to identify with Elsie's anguish unto her death. I undoubtedly would close her eyes, and I would be made a saint in the process, in my imagination. In reality, simply changing her position in bed, giving her head the bedpan tenderly, watching the 700 Club with her before I headed off to go to sleep at home. You know, it was much simpler. And that was part of my education in compassion towards an other. That's step two, compassion towards an other. There's a lot one could say about that in its own right, in its own way. It's a rigorous and profound spiritual practice, but not a small part of it. As with Elsie, there was the seeing through of projections. And I had the good grace to meditate at her bedside for 4 years and see through whatever projections I might lay on this woman that were about me. They were not about her. And that's obviously what projections are. But It often takes a while to see the nature of the projections, to really, really get it.
Oh, okay. So it's kind of like when we're having a judgment about another person. We're actually speaking of some aspect of ourselves.
Precisely, yeah.
Oh.
Precisely.
Oh, darn, I didn't want to hear that.
No, one never does.
Well, now that I've got that to deal with, am I back to self-compassion when I...
Definitely, yeah, thank you. That's exactly where you're at, you know, because we're all so... We're all just flawed, you know?
We're all what?
Well, we're flawed. We're a flawed lot.
Ah.
And the nature of any serious spiritual practice is being real with that and being compassionate towards oneself.
See, if they instead of calling it Planet Earth, they would have called it Planet Blem or something, for
yeah.
Blemished, that would have made it easier.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, that's... what is it, that extraordinary song by Leonard Cohen? He says, forget about your perfect offer ring. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. You know? That's the way it was with Elsie, in fact, that particular moment, because everything shifted. When I dropped, when I realized the impulse for idiot compassion. And if you're a caregiver, like I've been forever, idiot compassion is nonsense. Now, the MS thing, of course, as I said, I was diagnosed with MS. And before I was diagnosed, I had peripheral neuropathy from the waist down. I was numb. And it was undiagnosable until my legs started going away and they told me I had MS. You know, but it was merely my numb legs, I came back from Africa with these numb legs, immediately was floated to the neuro floor at UCLA Medical Center with people in various states of neurological disintegration. I clearly had a neurological symptom myself, that who knows what it was. The doctor, neurologist, told me most neuropathies are undiagnosable. And suddenly... the common ground. It wasn't about me, the whole and healthy guy, and you, the poor wretch of a patient. That apartheid fantasy was not tenable. I carried my own affliction, mysterious, and I was taking care of people who were ill. And that changed everything for me. It was a profound blessing.
Wow. Now, I'm just kind of curious, because one of the things about being in our culture, and you've spent time in other cultures in Africa,
mm-hmm.
so I don't have as much direct. I know I've spent time at Reverend Michael Beckwith's Zappi Church in L.A., and it's a wonderful energy of love and acceptance. One of the things that I was kind of curious about, because you're talking... of some hard situations with a lot of challenges for yourself and some of the people that you were dealing with, like Elsie.
Yeah.
Our culture, if you open a magazine, many magazines or TV programs, we're seeing people, very happy people, and they're on the beach somewhere, or they're having wonderful time snowboarding, and it's the beautiful people having beautiful lives, and so it's kind of this there's this portrayal, and part of that that's put out there, of course, because it's very much commercialism, is like, well, if you buy these things, you can have this, and if you're not this, then too bad for you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I know quite what you're talking about. And that has been some of the anguish of going between Africa and the United States. I mean, I literally go to Africa and come back literally and work at the hospital. And the food we routinely throw away, in any hospital, of course, would I mean, my people have dealt with famine big time in Zimbabwe. And the food we throw away is, it's obscene.
Mm.
Did I lose you?
Yeah. I'm... Hello, who is this? No,
I'm here.
I'm with you, Michael.
let me go to step three.
Yeah.
Of for me, the passage, the profound development of compassion that is the transformation of the soul, actually, it's got these three steps, I mean four steps, from self-compassion to being compassion, not being compassionate, but being compassion. Step three is kind of like, it's a step of transition, and it's a step towards a paradigm shift. Step three in Tibet is called Dekchen Nyamje, which is usually translated, God help us, equalizing and exchanging self and other. Not compassion towards another, but equalizing and exchanging. Now, I personally, first thing I did with this in my book, I was just saying, well, this is really kind of rhymes with the first person of Cherokee proverb, you can only understand another if you've walked three moons in his moccasins. That's something of what Dekchen Nyamje is. I changed that ultimately. I thought that's too complicated. I changed it to radical empathy. My education in Dekchen Nyamje, well, of course, being a young male housewife, of course, quite taken with feminism, like any housewife of that particular era. While my wife was at work and I was taking care of the kid, I was reading, oh, God knows, whatever, Kate Millay and Doris Lessing, you know. I was reading feminist literature.
Okay, so you weren't getting into the soap operas?
Oh, no. I've always despised television. I think it's evil, more or less. No, I wasn't watching the soap.
Oh, okay.
No, but when we did have a television, I was watching a lot of Sesame Street with my daughter.
Ah.
We were definitely fans of Sesame Street.
There you go. So you had a Sesame addiction.
I did. Yeah, I did. And I had a serious crush on Maria, you know.
Well, I tell you, there's a... Well, the world would be better off with a lot more Sesame addicts and Cookie Monsters.
Here we are, Cookie Monster. Jeff.
You know, a few of those.
Like Cookie.
at least it gave you a place to focus intense energies without hurting something.
Oh yeah.
You know,
But that was something of Dekchen Nyamje, to exchange. The thing about Dekchen, well, let me give you another example. After the L.A. riots here, when the Rodney King was, the verdict here, whatever, the riots that came out of the Rodney King verdict in 1992, Dina, my wife, Dina Metzger, and myself were at the bedside during the riots of a friend who had liver cancer. And she died that morning, like 2 or 3 a.m. And meanwhile, the helicopter's flying over, and there's smoke in the air. And at one point, they had taken her corpse away, and we were drinking wine and speaking tenderly about her, Hella. And a helicopter flew over, and I just started weeping. And I knew my next work, my first book, Dreaming the End of the World, which is about apocalyptic dreams, my next work was had to be about race and racism, because I was raised a Latino, Mexican, white boy in a racially divided world. And so I started collecting dreams for a book that I thought would be one volume about white people's dreams about black people and black people's dreams about white people. It became three volumes, two of which are published now. The Black People Dream About White People is called The Village of the Water Spirits. It is published. And early.
Now, do people like go to your website? I know there's a Michael Hill, MichaelOrtizHill.com. Would that be the best place to for people to get some of this? Or
bless you. You know something I don't know. There's a MichaelOrtizHill.com. I'm sorry. I'll talk about that a little bit later. I've had
trouble
with my website as of 3 days ago. It's expired. It's been taken over by some exactly the sort of people that you were talking about, the happy and whatever, you know.
Oh, okay.
The website was and may continue to be, hopefully later on this week, gatheringin.com. But my brother, who's my webmaster, is trying to change it, in fact, to MichaelOrtizHill.com. So, but that's another matter.
Oh, okay.
I say, go to Amazon. You'll find me there for sure.
All right. Okay. And that's Amazon.com versus the Amazon River in South America.
Because I'm sure.
You'd probably be down there, too, if we headed that way.
I know. I'm somewhere upriver. way upriver. Lost.
Yeah, there you go. Well, that's sometimes from being lost, it gives us a chance to then be found. And if we're never lost, we may not be found.
He that himself shall find himself, and he that findeth himself shall lose himself.
Yeah, so now, was there more to share this Dekshin?
No, there is.
What is it? How do you pronounce it? Dekshin?
Dekshin Namje, or radical empathy. The thing about Dekshin Namje, what happened with the race thing is I knew that for me to honor who African Americans are, I had to look at their dreams not from the angle of psychologies that were developed in America and Europe, but the traditional way. So I started exploring what are the origins of African-American culture. And, of course, I started dreaming a lot myself. As I was researching this, it was quite clear that black Americans were dreaming whites and whiteness very much within the same realm of imagery as Bantu, Congo, Angola, people from that part of Africa, which had a huge influence, a lot of slaves brought there. Same thing ever since the Portuguese turned up in that part of the world in the 1500s. And so I was, so what is this about? And I started dreaming. I dreamt Mandaza Kandemwa 4 years before I met him. His wife, Smakuke, dreamt me also. So when I finally arrived in Africa, in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe, we recognized one another.
You were truly a dream come true.
Literally, yeah. And I was taken into the tribal medicine as his Mapachka, which means twin brother in the Shona language, into the Ngoma of the water spirits. The reason I speak of, there's a lot to speak of which is also related to the multiple sclerosis, for example. But this is Dekchen Nyamje, because I had to write, I interviewed Mandaza, I gave him the dreams I collected from African Americans, and he interpreted them from the point of view of Ananga, a medicine man who works a lot with dreams in his healing practice. And so that's what gave birth to the Village of the Water Spirits book. Dekchen Nyamje, it was required that I empty myself out from myself in order to look at these dreams through the lens of someone African / African American. Of course, I was initiated into the medicine tradition. The Ngoma of the Water Spirits is formative to what became African American culture. So that's Dekchen Nyamje. When I was a teenager, I was quite swept up in, what is the name of it? Black Like Me, John Harry Griffin's book. He's a white man, a white writer, who during the time of the civil rights movement had his skin changed and went through the Deep South as a black man to seek what it was to be black in America then. And it was astonishing. The book really quite took me, as it did many people. That's Dekchen Nyamje, that quality of
equalizing the self with the other.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I call it radical empathy.
Yeah.
And it's a profound passage. It will change your life. And of course, it certainly did for me, becoming a Nanga and learning that way of medicine, especially having spent most of my adult life working in hospitals and being trained as a nurse, which is another way of medicine altogether.
Yeah. Yeah, you probably couldn't show up too much in the hospital in some of your African shaman outfits, could you?
Well, yet another book. Forgive me, I'm not being altogether self-promoting. The book that I wrote, first book I wrote with Mandaza, was Wind from Another Tribe, which is out by Quest Books, and it's his life story and my life story. And the chapters alternate, he, myself. And it's the memoir of twins. And there's several chapters about practicing as a Nanga, practicing African medicine in the hospital.
Yeah.
Which I did, you know, initially behind closed doors.
Ah, okay.
But I was sort of outed.
What, was it the trail of sage incense behind you? Or,
oh, right.
That gave you away? Or
I was, I would come to work a couple of hours before I began my night shift so I could meditate and just be open to being with my presence, my patient's presence.
Okay.
And I got up from the chapel and
or patient with your presence.
Right, and vice versa.
Yeah, it goes both ways.
Present with my patients and patient with my presence. Well, I got up.
All right, you carry on.
I shall. I'll try. I got up, and I was in the chapel, and I got up, and I went to just have a glass of water, you know, and there was Lone Eagle, who was a sun dancer, Lakota Indian, and he was, his son had been in a car accident, and he wanted to see his son. As he said, he was talking to the woman at the information desk because he wanted to do some doctoring. He put put it, which, of course, again, is not quite Western medicine. Not at all.
Yeah.
And I walked up to him, and I said, I'm a nurse here, and I'm a practitioner of tribal medicine in Zimbabwe, and it would be a great honor to lead you to your son. So I put on my name tag, put the stethoscope around my neck, changed persona.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm a professional nurse now. I'm not a meditator. I'm not a witch doctor. We went down into the ER, the emergency room, and his son wasn't there. He was in a CAT scan or an MRI. But they wheeled him in on a gurney after a little bit. And the ER was nuts. It was completely crazy. And the charge nurse thought I was obviously staff relief. And I said, no, we have an unusual situation here. And eventually they brought his son in, and his father feathered him. He had an eagle feather. And poured a little water and said a prayer in Lakota and wept over his son's prone body. And I asked Lone Eagle if he would serve his son's spirit if I ran some energy and sang an African song. And he said, oh, I would be honored if you did. And so I did. And the thing is, again, this is a very crowded ER. And it was astonishing. The parting of the Red Sea, everybody was very respectful to this tribal medicine that was happening in the major teaching hospital.
Mm.
And, of course, I was no longer in the closet at that point. Word spread. So.
Nurse by day, shaman by night, prone to switch in between.
Yeah.
Well, this is pretty exciting.
Now, let me finally, the fourth step.
Aha, I was wondering. I thought, is this a tease or do we get step four from this man?
Step four is what I call the mysterium. The mysterium is being compassion, not being compassionate, but being compassion. And when I speak of this, I often show, there's a wonderful New Yorker cartoon where the doctor is looking at the patient who looks quite worried, and the doctor's leveling with the patient. He says, well, I'm afraid to tell you that you've had a paradigm shift. Being compassion, the shift that happens with Jeshem Nyamje hopefully leads to being compassion. There's a dislodging from our personalized fantasy, God help us, me, the compassionate one, to actually simply manifesting and stepping forth as compassion. And it is a profound mystery, and it's very hard to speak of. And it's wonderful and challenging to teach it.
Well, I'm curious because I'm here attempting to make sense out of this in my mind going, okay, well, they're talking about being compassion versus being compassionate.
Yeah.
And so my kind of novice way of trying to make sense out of that was that if I am putting effort into these acts, and then I want to be compassionate and act in a particular way, and I can do what I can to direct myself in those directions.
Yes.
But then I thought, well, there can be a transition point at which I'm not thinking about it anymore. It has just become a natural part of me.
I think that's beautifully put. Yeah, it is a natural part, and it's not anybody being any particular way. It's like getting out of the way.
Oh, you mean there's this, I can't stand the thought, lurking goodness within us?
Oh, God forbid.
Oh, anything but that.
Anything but that. It's dreadful, isn't it? It undoes everything.
So that's where that expression namaste, when many people have heard of it, some haven't. This expression to say when you look at another, look them in each other's eyes, and are translating it, the divine in me salutes and acknowledges the divine in you.
That is precisely it. You got it. Thank you. That is precisely it. If you happen to be a Christian, it's very much as St. Paul says, not I, but Christ in me. One gets out of the way. So the spirit of compassion, which is profoundly receptive and profoundly intelligent, can step forth and do its thing. Now, listen, Ken, I'm very aware we're finishing at 4:55, are we?
Yeah, so we've got about 4 minutes to basically answer all the questions in the universe.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
So I may have to talk really, really fast.
I was going to read a poem, which in fact is sort of about being compassion.
Okay.
If I might.
Of course you might.
I'm afraid I'm going to get cut off in 4 minutes.
Can we have a a four-minute version? We do have to honor that there will be people following us on another radio show.
Well, tell them to go to hell.
Oh, well, thank you. I knew there was an answer.
Very compassion's answer.
We're doing a compassion. Get out of our way.
Exactly. You see what's important here? Okay, well, I'll read a portion of this poem, and I would refer people to my website to read it, except my website is down for the moment. So,
okay.
Oh, Lord. Right. The lover. Some
new website will be up shortly. The old one is no longer under your control. The Michael Ortiz Hill.
Well, Michael Ortiz Hill is never. I never had a website by then.
Okay. Well, it's got a picture of you and Dina on there. And
wait a minute. You're kidding.
No.
My God.
So this could be a fun surprise for you. I know the whole purpose of the show. So maybe being compassionate to you by revealing that you have a website that is functioning.
Okay.
That has there's a place you can click and download selections from your book, A Conspiracy of Kindness, The Craft of Compassion.
Well, you do know more than I know. My brother was speaking of doing this a couple of days ago, and apparently he's done it.
Okay, yeah, so people go to michaelortizhill.com. They will get to see a picture of you and Dina, your wife, and you, and is that the picture of your African-American twin brother there?
Yeah, he's African, though, not African-American. But
just African, okay. That's right, he's African-African.
Uh-huh.
Well, this would be a good opportunity. And sadly, we may have to we may have to delay on the poem, unfortunately.
Okay.
Can you give us just a minute of good advice, of wrap-up about compassion?
I will. Do it, live it.
Okay.
And my website, now that you've instructed me that it's actually on the computer, I don't see it on my computer this moment, but I certainly believe you. I have several chapters from my book, A Conspiracy of Kindness, Living Compassion at the Bedside of the Ill, which I'm going to send off to my publisher probably in a week or so.
Okay.
Read them. And it's about some of the stuff we've talked about, but it's basically reflections on what it is to live the compassionate life.
Well, that's great. I appreciate that. Michael, as we've come to the end of this program, but not to the end of compassion, I want to thank you so much for being a guest today and sharing with us, and just wish you a wonderful success with helping myself and our listeners and so many people out there to really go through the four steps to take care of ourselves compassionately and compassion for another, and to really walk in another's shoes, and then to finally be so good at compassion that it just flows from us naturally without thought or intention.
Now, Ken, can I swiftly? You're gone.
have to wrap this up, unfortunately, dear friend.
Connect with me, Michael Ortiz Hill at Verizon.net.
Ah, okay. So they want to email you at Michael Ortiz, O-R-T-I-Z, Hill, at Verizon.net?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So that would be another way to get in touch with you.
Yeah.
Ah, well, blessed be. Thank you so much. And dear listeners, wishing you and Michael a wonderful week with extra compassion, an extra helping of compassion for everyone. And tune in next week for another wonderful Advanced Living Radio program. And dear beloveds, until we meet again, God bless and goodbye for now. Let go and let God. Let go.